Pull up a chair. I want you to stand on a dock on Lake Washington up in Seattle, on a gray April morning in 1924. There's frost on the planking, the water is flat and cold and the color of gunmetal. And tied up along that shoreline are four open cockpit biplanes, big ones, riding on pontoons, their wooden propellers still, their engines ticking as they warm. Nobody standing there that morning really believed all four of them were coming back. Truth is, none of them did. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're going to talk about the first flight all the way around the world. Not the fastest, not the highest. The first. Before Wiley Post did it alone. Before anybody did it nonstop. Four Army airplanes and eight young men set out to fly a circle around the entire planet, and I don't think we say their names near enough anymore, so let's fix that. Before we get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. This show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you, the fellas in this story, if there'd been a coin for flying around the world, they'd have carried it in their pocket the rest of their lives. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Now, 1924. The Great War was 6 years in the rearview. Airplanes had grown up fast in that war, but the world still mostly thought of them as fragile toys, rich men's playthings, dangerous stunts. The United States Army Air Service, which is what the Air Force was called back then, had a problem. Congress didn't want to pay for airplanes. And the generals knew that if they were ever going to convince the country that aviation mattered, they needed to do something nobody could argue with. So they decided to fly around the world. Here's where it gets interesting. There was no airplane in existence built to do that. So the Army went to a young airplane builder down in Santa Monica, California, a fellow named Donald Douglas. You know that name. Douglas. The company that would one day give us the DC-3, the Goonie Bird herself. But in 1924, Donald Douglas was still a young man with a small shop and a big idea. The Army asked him to build a machine that could fly across oceans, across deserts, across jungle and ice. Douglas designed what he called the World Cruiser, a big single-engine biplane, open cockpits, two men sitting in a row out in the weather, one Liberty engine up front, a 12-cylinder, better than 400 horsepower, the same engine that had powered a lot of wartime airplanes. Water-cooled, loud, heavy, reliable, mostly. And here's the clever part. The World Cruiser could swap its landing gear. Over land, she rolled on wheels. But when the route ran across water for hundreds of miles at a stretch, the crews would jack her up, pull the wheels, and bolt on big pontoons so she could land on the sea. Same airplane. Two different sets of feet. They built five of them, one for testing, four for the journey, and each of the four was named for an American city: Seattle, Chicago, Boston, New Orleans. The plan was to head west and north first, up the coast of Canada and Alaska, then hop across to Asia, down through Japan and China, and Southeast Asia, across India and the Middle East, over Europe, then the long, dangerous jump across the North Atlantic, and home, around 27,000 miles, and nobody had ever done it. They left Seattle on the April 6th. Oh, April! Now I want you to think about what these men were flying into. No radar, no weather satellites, no radio worth speaking of in those airplanes. They navigated by looking out the window, by compass, by dead reckoning, by maps that in a lot of places were just wrong. Where there were no maps at all, they flew by whatever they could see, open cockpit. That means the wind is in your face at 90 miles an hour, hour after hour. And up in Alaska in April, that wind is cold enough to freeze the grease on your goggles. They wore leather and fur and wool and they still froze. They flew with their faces coated in whale oil to keep from getting frostbite. Think about that the next time your cabin heat isn't quite warm enough. The trouble started early, up in the Aleutians, that long chain of islands hanging off the tail end of Alaska. The weather is some of the meanest on Earth. Fog that comes out of nowhere. Willy-wah winds screaming down off the mountains, and the airplane named Seattle, carrying the commander of the whole expedition, a major named Frederick Martin, got separated in the fog. Martin and his mechanic, a sergeant named Alva Harvey, were feeling their way through thick gray soup with mountains they couldn't see. And they flew straight into one, hit the side of a mountain in the fog. Now, by some grace, they lived. Walked away from the wreck of the Seattle, up on a frozen mountainside in the middle of nowhere. And then those two men walked, for 10 days. They walked through snow and freezing rain and wilderness, no idea if anyone would ever find them, until they finally stumbled into a fishing cannery on the coast, alive. The commander of the flight was out before they'd even left the Americas. Command passed to a young lieutenant flying the Chicago. His name was Lowell Smith, and Smith made a decision that tells you everything about these men. The airplane and crew that were supposed to lead were gone. The mission could have folded right there. Instead, Smith gathered the three remaining airplanes, Chicago, Boston, New Orleans, and pressed on. They made the jump across the Pacific to Asia, and here's a detail I love. In some of those far-flung places, the Army had gone ahead and staged supplies, fuel, and spare parts by ship. Cans of gasoline sitting on a beach in the Aleutians, crates of spare Liberty engines waiting in a harbor in Japan. Because these airplanes chewed through engines, they'd fly a leg, and if the engine was worn or damaged, the crews themselves out on a beach or a riverbank would pull the whole engine and hang a new one. No hangar, no hoist half the time, just young men, wrenches, and their own backs. They flew down through Japan, and the crowds came out to see them through China, landing on rivers, across the jungles and heat of Southeast Asia, where the problem wasn't ice anymore, it was heat so bad the engines nearly cooked, and rain that came down in sheets. Through India, across the deserts of the Middle East, where the sand got into everything, up into Europe, where they were met like heroes in every capital, and everywhere they went, the world cruisers held together. Fabric and wood and wire and one faithful Liberty engine patched and nursed and swapped, one leg at a time, all the way around the world. Then came the North Atlantic. Now in 1924, the North Atlantic was the graveyard. It was the jump that scared everybody. Cold water, fog, storms, and if your engine quit out there, you went into the sea and that was the end of you. They planned the crossing carefully, from Europe up through the Faroe Islands and Iceland and Greenland, hopping the shortest possible stretches of open water, with Navy ships stationed along the way to fish them out if it came to that. It came to that. The airplane named Boston, flown by Lieutenant Lee Wade and his mechanic Henry Ogden, developed engine trouble out over the North Atlantic, between the Faroes and Iceland, oil pressure dropping, and out there, over that cold gray water, the Liberty finally gave up. Wade put her down on the open ocean, on the pontoons. In the swells of the North Atlantic, and that, friends, is airmanship. They got her down in one piece, and the two men climbed out onto the wings and waited on the heaving sea until a Navy ship found them and hauled them aboard. They tried to tow the Boston, but the sea was too rough, and the old girl took on water and finally sank beneath the waves. They lost the airplane, but the crew lived, so now think about the count. They started with four. The Seattle was wrecked on an Alaskan mountain, the Boston was at the bottom of the North Atlantic, two down, two crews rescued, thank God, but two airplanes gone and two left. Chicago and New Orleans. Here's where it gets interesting one more time. The Army had that fifth airplane, the prototype, the test machine. They shipped it up to Nova Scotia, gave it the name Boston 2, and Wade and Ogden, the crew that went into the ocean, climbed back into an airplane to finish the ride. Now that's what I call not quitting. The last legs ran down through Nova Scotia, into the United States, and the country went absolutely wild. Crowds by the tens of thousands. They flew across America, city to city, and on the 28th of September 1924, the Chicago and the New Orleans came back down onto the water at Seattle, right where they'd started. The circle was closed. 175 days. Around 27,000 miles, something like 74 stops in more than 20 countries. And for the first time in all of human history, men had flown an airplane the whole way around the world. Two crews made the complete circle. Lowell Smith and Leslie Arnold in the Chicago. Eric Nelson and John Harding in the New Orleans. And I want to say their names again, slow, because they earned it. Lowell Smith, Leslie Arnold, Eric Nelson, John Harding. And don't you forget the ones who didn't finish, but never failed. Frederick Martin and Alva Harvey, who walked 10 days out of the Alaskan wilderness. Lee Wade and Henry Ogden, who ditched in the North Atlantic and then climbed back into another airplane to see it through. Eight men, four airplanes, one went into a mountain, one went into the ocean, and two came home. Now here's the part I really want you to sit with. We talk about the great flights. Lindbergh, alone across the Atlantic. That was 3 years after this, 1927. Amelia Yeager and the Sound Barrier. And those flights deserve every bit of the glory they get, but the Douglas World Cruisers came first, and they proved something bigger than a single crossing. They proved the airplane could go anywhere. Any ocean, any desert, any range of mountains on the face of the earth. There was no place left that an airplane couldn't reach. And that young airplane builder down in Santa Monica, Donald Douglas. His little company had just flown around the world before most of America had ever sat in an airplane. They started saying it around the industry. First around the world, Douglas. A few years later, he built the DC-3, and the DC-3 taught the whole world to fly. But it started here. It started with four open cockpit biplanes and eight cold, stubborn young men who wouldn't turn around. You can go see the Chicago today. She hangs in the Smithsonian in the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, and the New Orleans survives too, out in California. Go stand under one of them if you ever get the chance. Look at how small she is. Look at that open cockpit. And then think about ice, and fog, and the North Atlantic, and whale oil smeared on a young man's face to keep the frostbite off. That'll put your next cross-country in perspective real quick. Back when Avgaz was cheap and airspace was free, folks like to say that the age of adventure was already over, that everything had already been done. 1924 says otherwise. Now for the story of that flight, I leaned on the histories kept by the National Air and Space Museum and the record left behind by the United States Air Force of what was then the Army Air Service. You can read more and find the rest of our shows over at RadioHanger.com. Next time you're feeling brave on a two-hour hop with a full tank and a moving map glowing on your panel, just remember the Chicago and the New Orleans and eight fellas who did it the hard way, the first way, all the way around. This is Tail Dragger, keep the greasy side down, and I'll see you back here in the hangar.